أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Sufi Reflections. On a regular, irregular basis, this podcast is intended, God willing, to introduce you to a wide variety of commentaries, ideas, stories, essays, discussions, interviews, and perspectives concerning not only the Sufi path or tasawwuf, but life in general as well. Through fact, fiction, possibilities, questions, and reflections, this podcast seeks to engage you on a journey of discovery in relation to issues and themes of relevance and significance to everyday life. I am not a sheikh, but I have, by the grace of Allah, been on the Sufi path for over 30 years, and I have benefited greatly by working closely with a Sufi saint of the 20th century for nearly two decades. This podcast is not about trying to guide people on the path, but rather to share some of what I and others have learned in conjunction with pursuing a Sufi way of life. My name is Bill Whitehouse, and God willing, I shall be your host for Sufi Reflection. You have learned the trade to earn a livelihood for the body. Now, set your hand to a spiritual trade. In this world, you have become clothed and rich. When you come forth from here, how will you fare? Learn such a trade that hereafter the earning of God's forgiveness may come in as revenue to you. The earnings of spirituality are love and inward rapture. Capacity to receive the light of God. O thou obstinate one, this vile fleshy soul desires you to earn that which passes away. How long will you earn what is vile? Let it go. Enough. If the vile fleshy soul desires you to earn that which is noble, there is some trick and plot behind it. This is from the writings of Jalaluddin Rumi. May Allah be pleased with him.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Wal-layli idha yaghsha wan-nahari idha tajalla wa ma khalaqa adh-dhakara wal-untha inna sa'yakum lashatta. فَأَمَّا مَنْ أَعْطَى وَاتَّقَى وَصَدَّقَ بِالْحُسْنَى فَسَنُيَسِّرُهُ لِلْيُسْرَى وَأَمَّا مَنْ بَخِلَ وَاسْتَغْنَى وَكَذَّبَ بِالْحُسْنَى فَسَنُيَسِّرُهُ لِلْعُسْرَى وَمَا يُغْنِي عَنْهُ مَالُهُ إِذَا تَرَدَّى.
By the night enshrouding and the day resplendent, and him who hath created male and female, lo, your effort is dispersed toward diverse ends. As for him who giveth and is dutiful toward Allah, and believeth in goodness, surely we will ease his way unto the state of ease. But as for him who hoardeth and deemeth himself independent, and disbelieveth in goodness, surely we will ease his way unto adversity. His riches will not save him when he perisheth.
Inna alayna lalhuda wa inna lana lalakhirata wal-oola fa'anzartukum naran talazza la yaslaha illa al-ashqa alladhi kazzaba wa tawalla وسيجنبها الأتقى الذي يؤتي ماله يتزكى وما لأحد عنده من نعمة تجزى إلا ابتغاء وجه ربه الأعلى ولسوف يرضى.
Lo, ours it is to give the guidance. And lo, unto us belong the latter portion and the former. Therefore, have I warned you of the flaming fire, which only the most wretched must endure. He who denieth and turneth away, Far removed from it will be the righteous, who giveth his wealth, that he may grow in goodness. And none hath with him any favor for reward, except as seeking to fulfill the purpose of his Lord Most High. He verily will be content.
One of the features that, God willing, will run fairly regularly on this podcast is a segment entitled Sufi Essays. As the title suggests, these pieces will be commentaries, sometimes brief and sometimes longer, about a variety of topics which, hopefully, may provide you with some thoughts on which to reflect. This essay is entitled Spirit. They will ask thee concerning the Spirit, say, The Spirit is by command of my Lord, and of its knowledge you have been vouchsafe but little. This is from the Quran, Surah 17, Ayat 85. The Spirit is said to be the locus of manifestation of love. Indeed, the proper vocation of the Spirit is nothing but love. According to Sufi masters, there is a dimension of the heart which gives expression to love. However, this facet of the heart, when it becomes spiritually active, is consumed with love of human beings specifically and all of creation in general. There is another level of the heart that gives expression to love for the divine presence. The love of the Spirit is complementary and supplemental to this kind of love of divinity. The Spirit is dedicated completely to love of God. However, the Spirit's capacity for divine love, when it becomes perfected, illumines, shapes, colors, and moves the love of the heart. The Spirit is described by Sufi masters as having certain qualities. These qualities are familiarity, forbearance, light, love, life, knowledge, and permanence. The familiarity of the Spirit is primordial in character. It is shaped by the experience of being brought by God from non-existence into created existence. Furthermore, this aspect of familiarity reverberates with the original covenant of commitment between the Spirit and God. The Spirit's quality of forbearance addresses, among other things, the Spirit's capacity to refrain from everything except fulfilling the conditions of servanthood. Three spiritual currents run through this quality of forbearance, namely, modesty, tranquility, and dignity. Being modest in all things before God is one of the characteristics of a true servant. Moreover, through servanthood, one derives both essential dignity and tranquility. A third quality of the Spirit involves light. This potential encompasses hearing, speech, and vision. The servant of God hears the call of divinity and responds in order to serve the will of God. Through speech, the servant of God also is busy with praise, glorification, and worship of divinity. By means of vision, the servant experiences the overwhelming beauty and majesty of divinity. Love is another quality of the Spirit. The love of the Spirit is marked by yearning, seeking, and sincerity. The one in love always yearns for the beloved and is never happy away from the beloved. Restlessness characterizes the one who is separated from the source of all happiness, joy, and unity. Our restlessness in this world is a reflection of the Spirit's yearning to be reunited with the Beloved. No matter what we do or try until we are wholly with the Beloved, we always will remain restless. The one in love constantly is seeking the object of love. The individual sees traces and signs of that which is sought after almost everywhere. In fact, the individual keeps mistaking the signs for the reality of which the signs are but a trace. As a result, the person becomes involved in one affair after another with the things of the world. The individual is attracted by things because the seeking spirit catches a reflection of the beloved in those things. The individual falls in love with the things only to discover, in time, those things are not what the spirit is really seeking after all. The spiritual journey constitutes the search of the spirit. The spirit seeks the only reality with which the spirit can feel fully satisfied, complete, and at peace. To sustain the spiritual journey, one needs sincerity. Without sincerity, one will never be able to withstand the trials, difficulties, and challenges which the one sought has created to test the quality of love of the would-be suitor. Furthermore, once, God willing, the quest of the spirit has been realized through being reunited with the beloved, there will be further need of sincerity. The servant proves the sincerity of his or her love by fulfilling the request made by the beloved. From the spirit's quality of life comes a variety of capacities or potentials. These include not only intelligence, but as well a whole spectrum of different modes of perception. When these potentials are perfected, they become tools through which the individual serves God. Moreover, these qualities of intelligence and perception become so many different modalities for experiencing as well as giving expression to love of God. The spirit's capacity for knowledge entails two themes. One theme involves cognition. The other aspect concerns will. The cognition referred to here is not a reference to brain functioning, which is the usual sense of this term. The cognition of the spirit is a matter of the spirit's ability, when perfected, to understand through love of divinity. Love has its own unique way of knowing and understanding. When the individual comes to realize experientially through the spirit the infinite breadth, depth, and richness of God's love, everything in the life of the individual becomes infused with and illuminated by such love. Knowledge and understanding both see through the eyes of divine love. Love is not passive, it is active and dynamic. That which is known and understood through the vision of divine love is acted upon. Consequently, the quality of will entailed by the knowledge of the Spirit seeks, with God's permission, to put understanding into action in the service and worship of divinity. Finally, the Spirit's quality of permanence encompasses dimensions of steadfastness and persistence. Each of these dimensions colors permanence in a different manner. To be steadfast is to be constant in one's love for and service to and worship of God. The perfected spirit is a perpetual motion machine which generates a constant reflection of divine love. Sufi masters radiate and glow with the quality of steadfastness. It permeates every aspect of their being. In addition, the quality of permanence contains the potential for persistence. Long after all traces of the body and the world have disappeared from the face of existence, the spirit will persist in its journey from God to God, through God, by God, and with God. When we come into this world, the potentials of the spirit's capacity are unrealized for the most part. They need to be perfected. When one steps onto the mystical path, one begins the journey towards, among other things, the perfection of the spirit. There are various stages to this journey. Different Sufi masters describe these stages in different ways. The central themes of these descriptions, however, are essentially the same. One way of providing an overview of the stages of the journey towards perfection of the spirit is as follows. The journey can be construed in terms of 9 themes. These are compatibility, inclination, fellowship, passion, friendship, exclusive friendship, ardent affection, enslavement, and bewilderment. Before one decides to undertake a journey with someone, one wants to have a sense of how compatible the companion is with whom one is contemplating taking the journey. Although the ultimate companion for the journey is really divinity, one tries to evaluate compatibility through divinity's surrogate for the journey, namely, the Sheikh. If one feels comfortable with the degree of perceived compatibility between oneself and the spiritual guide, one begins to think about departure. However, before one really gets underway, there are some unresolved matters that need to be addressed. To begin with, one soon discovers there are some adjustments in one's thinking about and attitudes towards the issue of compatibility which are necessary. Most importantly, if one is fortunate, one begins to realize one must learn how to be compatible with the Sheikh. The spiritual guide is an experienced traveler. One has never been on this journey before. If one wants to reach the destination of one's journey, one had best start following the advice and counsel of the spiritual guide. This is true compatibility. One travels beyond compatibility through inclination. To be inclined to the Sheikh and therefore God is to become inclined to the way of life of the Sheikh. Over time, and if God wishes, one becomes inclined to the beliefs, values, actions, goals, and qualities of the Sheikh. Once inclination has become established, a bond of fellowship arises in relation to the Sheikh. One begins to enjoy traveling with the spiritual guide. One accepts the ups and downs of the journey and is happy to be going through all of this with the Sheikh as one's guide and companion of the way. Out of the bond of fellowship arises passion. One cannot bear to think of traveling without the Sheikh. One would feel lost and adrift. Consequently, one holds tightly, passionately, to the hand of one's spiritual guide. Friendship is given birth through passion. One keeps nothing from the friend. Nothing is hidden from the friend. One finds comfort, contentment, and peace through the friend. One confides in one's friend with respect to one's doubts, worries, concerns, and difficulties. And the friend helps one in and with everything. Exclusive friendship follows upon friendship. One really has no thoughts, interests, or aspirations that are not centered around the friend. Meaning, purpose, value, and significance rise and set with the friend's presence. One has been falling in love with the Sheikh since the days of compatibility, but in the stage of ardent affection, one begins to feel the stirrings of a deep, intense, abiding affection for the Sheikh. One fears doing anything that would displease the spiritual guide. In the stage of ardent affection, even on the most storm-filled days, the sun shines brilliantly and warmly when the Sheikh is pleased with one. On the other hand, even on the sunniest of days, the air is heavy with darkness and sadness when one feels the Sheikh is displeased with one's effort or demeanor on the path. At the far edge of the stage of ardent affection, one trips over enslavement and falls deeply, completely, desperately in love. In this condition, one gladly would sacrifice whatever one has or is for the Sheikh. When enslaved by love, one's life has no meaning or value except in the context of one's love for the Sheikh. All one's joy, happiness, and fulfillment are derived from being engaged in loving service to and for the Sheikh. Bewilderment is the next stop on the journey after enslavement. So many different manifestations of the wonder, majesty, and beauty of love are disclosed in this condition that one becomes overwhelmed. One both understands and does not understand at the same time. In short, one is bewitched, bothered, and bewildered, in a spiritual sense, of course. All through the foregoing journey, there is a growing realization within the individual. This growing realization manifests itself in a different way with each new stage. The nature of the realization is this. One's companion on the journey is far more complex than one originally imagined to be the case. The Sheikh is, on the one hand, a unique manifestation of all the Sheikhs who have preceded the spiritual guide on the mystical path. Furthermore, the Sheikh is a unique, reflected manifestation of the entire
prophetic tradition. On the other hand, the wayfarer realizes more and more that underwriting all of these manifestations is none other than divinity. God is teaching, helping, supporting, protecting, guiding, nurturing, and transforming the individual through the agencies of manifestation we recognize as the Sheikh, the saints, and the prophets. When these realizations come to their full fruition, with the completion of the aforementioned journey of love, the spirit, with all its previously discussed qualities, will become perfected, God willing. Therefore, everything which is done, seen, heard, willed, experienced, perceived, spoken, known, understood, sought, and yearned for, will be in terms of and an expression of divine love. Such love will be the modest, dignified, tranquil, steadfast, persistent love of the servant of God.
The water is wide, I cannot cross more, and neither
build me a boat that will carry.
You have been listening to the song The Water is Wide by Shira Kamen from the Music of Waters CD, courtesy of Magnatunes.com, a great place for interesting quality music at prices you choose, and half the purchase price goes to the artist. This poem is entitled The Way Home. Choice is a space with many rooms, yet with just two ways to go. A maze into which we are born with limited time to know how to proceed. Our life is torn between lower and higher entreaties that caress our heart, callings to which we aspire, potentials that set us apart, in journeys that twist and turn among fates that mark boundaries within which we move and learn, like lowly oars in dark foundries, so fragile, easy to break. Each soul needs work and grace to bring out its value, a high-stake drama which takes flight on the wing of time that, like a midwife, delivers from darkness to light. The changing rhythms of life through which we struggle to gain sight of our core self, of why we are, and all that these truths entail. Take warning. The web of free will is subtle and spreads its tail across cosmic filaments, vibrating human intentions that form living testaments brought forth by divine conventions on a day we all must face. This story is entitled, What's Your Secret?
There was a man described by some as being mystically inclined, who was renowned for his ability to get difficult conflicts resolved, warring nations, divisive stockholders, labor strife, collapsing governments, as well as a number of failing marriages among the rich and famous, had all benefited from his counsel and negotiating skills. However, for whatever reason, the man always had insisted that participating parties sign a contract prior to the commencement of even preliminary discussions concerning a given issue or problem. The conditions of this contract would bind everyone concerned to absolute silence with respect to what took place during discussions and ensuing activities which hopefully led to resolution of a given problem. The nature of the contract was such that everyone was held collectively responsible for breaches committed by any individual connected with the conflict resolution process, and the financial penalties were rumored to be quite substantial. Whether out of fear of the monetary consequences in legal entanglements, or due to the fact that the man had never failed in any assignment he accepted, in which the condition of silence was honored by all parties, an aura of inviolability tended to shroud his activities, methods, comments, and suggestions whenever he was engaged in a process of conflict resolution. Moreover, because this man was a very private individual, and therefore rarely gave interviews of any kind, there were few clues available which might shed light on how or why he seemed to be so successful with situations that on the surface often appeared not to be amenable to being resolved in a harmonious fashion. A faculty member of a prestigious university who had cross appointments in both the School of Management and the School of Public Administration knew that the aforementioned conflict resolution specialist was getting on in years, and the professor feared that a great treasure of knowledge would be lost forever if steps were not taken before the man died to try to establish a permanent record of how this individual was able to so regularly work his magic in situations laden with tension and animosity. So he spoke with various deans within the university, as well as its president and the board of trustees, about taking a leave of absence in order to try to persuade the man who could resolve conflicts to record his extensive knowledge, techniques, methods, and so on, in order that such understanding could be passed on to subsequent generations. The plan was approved. Shortly thereafter, the professor began his quest. Although due to the notorious reclusiveness and reticence of the focus of his research project, the scholar was anticipating that his task would prove to be both difficult and time-consuming. He was quite surprised when he was granted an appointment to meet with the great man early in the following week. The professor was to be given just 1 hour to ask whatever questions he wished, and there would be no follow-up meetings permitted. realizing that an hour was not very much time in which to gather information that might affect the way courses in conflict resolution would be taught in universities for generations to come, the professor struggled to try to come up with questions that hopefully were capable of penetrating to the heart of the matter and induce the man to divulge some of his secrets. After several days of hard work, the professor felt ready to conduct his interview. When the time for the meeting arrived, the professor was escorted into a sort of large boardroom where the man to be interviewed was awaiting the scholar's arrival. The two shook hands and took seats. After exchanging a few preliminary remarks, the professor decided to ask his first question, and as he did, he encountered the first of many problems. The scholar would ask a question, and he would be met with responses such as, "I'm sorry, but that is classified information," or, "Contractual obligations prevent me from answering that," or, "I would need the permission of so-and-so to be able to provide you with any information on this," or, "This touches upon ongoing negotiations, and therefore I am not at liberty to comment," or, "That decision has been sealed by the courts." Question after question was met with similar responses. The time allotted for the interview was rapidly drawing to an end, and the professor had not come up with one useful piece of information. The great resolver of conflicts could tell that the scholar was frustrated with the way things were going in the interview. The former man smiled sympathetically and a little sheepishly, saying, as he did, "I'm sorry if I seem very uncooperative. This was not my intention when I granted the interview. I truly did hope that maybe, if circumstances permitted, something of value to you and possibly others might arise out of our meeting." There really are some very important reasons why information concerning these issues are so tightly controlled. Much of our success depends on such secrecy being maintained in a very rigorous manner, and if this sort of information were to become public knowledge, many of our future efforts might be undermined and come to naught. Looking at his watch, he continued on, "I fear our time is nearly at an end, but there may be one thing I can do for you before you leave. What I have in mind is this. There are several brief meetings which I have to conduct in this room. Why don't you sit in on these meetings, and perhaps you may catch a small sense of the flavor of how we go about things, and therefore you won't feel your time has been wasted." The professor wanted to try to make the best of what had proven to be a very disappointing set of circumstances, and consequently he agreed to the suggestion. His host requested that the professor just observe during the meetings, and if the scholar had any questions or comments concerning what went on, to please wait until the two meetings had been completed. The great resolver of conflicts pressed one of the buttons on the intercom and asked for someone to be sent in. A short while later, a woman entered the room. She took the seat indicated, and as soon as she was seated, she began to complain about one of her co-workers who worked with the great resolver of conflicts. The woman went on for some time, describing how the man was creating difficulties of one sort or another with a certain project. When she had finished, the resolver of conflicts said, "Yes, yes, you are quite right in what you are saying. I will have a talk with him, and let's see what happens." The woman left happy with the result of their meeting. As soon as she had left the room, the man again pressed one of the buttons on the intercom and asked for the individual about whom the woman just had been complaining. The door opened and a man walked in. He took the seat where the woman previously had sat. He was asked, "So, how is such and such a project going?" As soon as the question was raised, the man who had just entered began to criticize the woman who recently had left the room. The man spoke critically about the woman approximately as long as she had gone on about him, and he voiced many of the same sorts of criticism. When the man stopped talking, the great resolver of conflict said, "You are right, and I couldn't agree with you more. We'll have to look into this matter carefully and see what can be done." The man, who previously had been the focus of the woman's complaint, stood, expressed his gratitude for having had the opportunity to speak, and walked out of the room. When the man had left the room, closing the door behind him, the scholar's host swiveled in his chair and faced the professor with a look that invited the scholar to speak whatever might be on his mind. The professor hesitated for a moment, unsure whether or not to say what he was thinking. Finally he said, "I might be missing something here, but quite frankly, your conduct during these two meetings seems rather contradictory. A woman comes in and complains about a man, and you agree with her. Then, the man about whom she was complaining comes in and proceeds to criticize that woman for having made the same sorts of mistake as the woman alleged with respect to the man, and once more, you completely agreed with the complaints. What those two people were saying was diametrically opposed. They couldn't both be simultaneously correct. The man looked at the professor, nodded his head, and replied, "You're absolutely right."
The following is an unpaid advertisement by the sponsors of this podcast. It concerns the newly released book, The Chaco Canyon Tapes.
The Chaco Canyon Tapes by Dr. Bill Whitehouse is a book which is difficult to categorize. While it has the appearance of a novel, the work is really a series of essays focusing on an array of contemporary issues. In fact, the novel aspect itself constitutes a distributed essay which weaves its way through the different dimensions of the book. Simultaneously, the storyline provides an emotional, creative center of gravity which is intended to help stabilize as well as lend both a source of coherency and accessibility to the various topics developed throughout the Chaco Canyon Tapes. In its capacity as a novel, the book traces the journey of a psychology professor, David Phelps, who traverses a path from an initial agnosticism at the story's inception to a budding acceptance of spiritual possibilities at the story's conclusion. In its capacity as a series of essays, the chapters constitute the experientially based contemplative exercises that are shaping and coloring the central figure's spiritual transformation. The story ranges across an assortment of kidnappings, murders, mysteries, intrigues, rescues, and relationships. The plot development, characterization, dialogue, as well as the dramatic tension and resolution of this story are employed to induce readers to undertake a quest somewhat similar to that of the main character. However, the reader's journey need not be so much a matter of following the travels of David Phelps, which extend from agnosticism to belief, as much as it is a journey of opportunity to engage, from a spiritual perspective, a set of important, interrelated issues of our times. This is not a book of metaphysics, theology, or religious polemic. Rather, it is an invitation to experience, within determinate limits, a certain kind of spiritual orientation and ambiance while pushing against problems which frame human existence. Purpose, identity, meaning, valuation, understanding, justice, freedom, responsibility, potential, commitment, and choice are very much at the heart of Chaco Canyon. This story of spiritual awakening, together with its concomitant thematic explorations, provide a context for reflecting on matters of fundamental concern to all of us.
To order a copy, just go to http://spiritual-health.org/Chaco Canyon, that's capital C, H-A-C-O, capital C-A-N-Y-O-N, all one word, .htm. Order your copy today without delay. Without further ado, we will return you to the regularly scheduled portions of the Sufi Reflections podcast. The Sufi path is not just about aspiring to spiritual understanding concerning the potential of one's inherent God-given capacity, but as well, tasawwuf should entail an application of spiritual principles to the problems and events of everyday life. Consequently, from time to time, this podcast will offer reflections on different facets of various social, political, economic, and ecological issues of the day. The purpose of these commentaries is not to induce people to pursue this or that action or policy. Rather, the intention of such commentaries is to provide food for thought, which, God willing, may serve to support responsible, moral, considered action according to one's circumstances and best understanding. For want of a better name, I refer to these occasional commentaries as White House Briefs. Although given my nature, some of the commentaries are not always so brief. Today's selection is entitled The Boundary Problem. The following comments arose in conjunction with a woman who was being abused by her husband, as were her children. She had tried many things in order to make the marriage work, but all to no avail. She didn't know where to go or to whom to turn in order to find a resolution to her problem. Moreover, because of the many biases and prejudices that exist within all too many mosques and among all too many imams concerning women, she was reluctant to go to such places and people in order to get help and counseling. I wish there was some simple way to answer your question, but I do not believe this is possible. Or perhaps more accurately, a simple response might be offered, but without an appropriate context to give the answer perspective and rigor, the simple reply would have little educational value for you or anyone else, since in truth your problem is, I believe, just the tip of a very considerable spiritual iceberg, which many people sense is running loose in the channels of life. Yet the issue of how to avoid this hazard to navigation without getting sunk is a very omnipresent problem. Moreover, the only real answer that can be given to the question you are raising is more in the way of food for thought that, when reflected upon, may help you to select a direction which, God willing, may be of service to you. In providing such food for thought, there are quite a few themes that must be addressed, so I request your patience and forbearance while making the journey through what follows. Your problem raises a lot of very important questions. Questions which are rooted in a variety of issues of abuse and ultimately, since all abuse is an expression of the presence of spiritual difficulties, the problems that you describe and to which you allude are, in my opinion, quite appropriate topics for this forum. However, I also will say that your question opens what many will consider to be a huge Pandora's box, something such people do not wish to be opened because the raising of the lid of this box presents them with challenges that are very disturbing to and uncomfortable for them. However, personally, I do not look at the issues to which your question points to be a sort of evil leashed upon the world, as was in mythology allegedly the case with Pandora's actions, but in truth was undoubtedly just another attempt to lay the ills and troubles of the world at the feet of a woman, as many have tried to do with Eve, may Allah be pleased with her. although the Quran clearly indicates that both Adam, peace be upon him, and his mate were equally responsible for transgressing against the bounds established by divinity. In any event, I agree with the words which have been attributed to Socrates, namely, quote, "The unexamined life is not worth living," end of quote. And therefore, I welcome the problem with which you have presented us, heavy though my heart may be, concerning the circumstances, both specifically with you and generally with the state of the Muslim world, which makes your difficulty the kind of problem it is, one in which a person in trouble is disinclined to go to the local mosque, imam, mullah, or ulama out of fear of being abused by the biases, prejudices, misunderstandings, arrogance, ignorance, and presumptions one may encounter in relation to either woman or the teachings of Islam. In general, people like to feel settled in their lives. Many people want to be reassured that the manner in which they believe is the correct way to do things. And many of these individuals become nervous when the possibility arises that maybe, just maybe, there might be other, perhaps even better ways of doing things, or even more troublesome, that there may be enough degrees of freedom in the divine plan that different people may choose different modalities of engaging God, and, oh no, God might be equally well disposed towards many of the choices which human beings make, as long as we, in accordance with the guidance of the Quran, do not transgress beyond certain boundaries. The identifying of some of these boundaries has proven relatively problematic over the centuries. One might refer to this issue of identification as the boundary problem. In different schools of kalam, philosophy, hadith, theology, jurisprudence, and mysticism have arisen in an attempt to, among other things, address the complexities of the boundary problem, since in truth, the boundary problem envelops almost every aspect of life on earth. Someone once asked a Sufi sheikh to provide a definition of tasawwuf, or the mystical way. The teacher thought for a moment and then responded with just one word, adab, that is, spiritual etiquette. As the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is reported to have said, quote, "Surely your soul has a right against you, your Lord has a right against you, your guest has a right against you, and your wife has a right against you. So give to each one who possesses a right against you," end of quote. In fact, all of creation has rights against us and vice versa. And the science of doing justice to creation is the practice of adab. Prophet, peace be upon him, is reported to have said, quote, "Creation is like God's family, for its sustenance is from Allah. Therefore, the most beloved unto God is the individual who does good to God's family," end of quote. Observing, noting, acknowledging, understanding, respecting, and acting upon the rights of all the different facets and dimensions of creation is the essence of adab, for it is the means through which justice is dispensed so that everything is given what is its right to be given. The Quran indicates that, quote, "God commands you to deliver trust back to their owner," end of quote, and this is from Surah 4, Ayat 58. And adab is the modality of returning such trust back to each and every thing of existence. Quote, "O ye who believe, be steadfast witnesses for Allah in equity," end of quote, and this is from Surah 5, Ayat 8. But what are these rights? And what is the precise nature of the good which we should do to God's family? And what is the specific character of the trust which should be returned to their owners? Many people have responded in very different ways in relation to the questions being raised here, as well as in relation to many other similar questions. The boundary problem is a matter of adab, justice, rights, trust, truth, and understanding, halal, permissible, haram, forbidden, makruh, doubtful, fard, obligatory, wajib, incumbent or highly recommended, sunnah, recommended, and mubah, as one likes or as one chooses, are some of the terms which are used to mark out the boundaries of lived existence. In exoteric approaches to jurisprudence or Sharia, the tools that are employed to try to identify the appropriate applications of the aforementioned terms are akal, reason, qiyas, analogy, ijma, consensus of the ulama or learned ones, and ijtihad, individual striving, which is a variant on the root for jihad. Among the people of tasawuf, tahqiq is a tool of choice, that is, verification of the nature of things through the process of kashf, or unveiling, and yaqeen, that is, direct, certain vision or grasping. And one might remember that in addition to profession of the tongue and action of the limbs, the Prophet, peace be upon him, is reported to have said that verification of the heart is a necessary and essential component of faith. That is, faith is not the blind commitment which many people suppose, and to seek an increase in faith is really to seek an increase in the verification of that which is true. In all of the foregoing, the notion of taqlid, of following authority, often plays a very prominent role. And interestingly enough, taqlid is derived from the same root as qilada, which means collar or necklace. The one who follows a given authority wears the authority like a collar or necklace, which binds such an individual to the provisions and characteristics of whatever form of authority is being used as a guidance in a given matter. And herein, the nature of the problem confronting us, and to which your questions allude, begins to become apparent. Obviously, the highest and best form of taqlid, or process of following authority, is to merge horizons with the divine so that one sees with the sight of divinity, and one hears with the hearing of divinity, and one acts through the hands of divinity, and one walks along the path of life in accordance with the guidance of divinity. And just as obviously, everyone and his or her twin sister or brother has an opinion about what this all entails, about what constitutes a proper expression of taqlid. However, there are a few potholes along the path in search of who, if anyone, has the best understanding of such authoritativeness. Moreover, there is a formidable difference between accepting something on authority in a blind fashion and accepting something as being authoritative because of coming to understand the strength of the wisdom, insight, practicality, rigor, and reasonableness which is being given expression through a particular perspective or judgment concerning such issues. In addition, in this modern day and age, we have another complicating factor to throw into the mix. More specifically, there are two possible worlds, namely Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb. Dar al-Islam is the realm where the deen or way of Islam governs, informs, organizes, and orients the space within which life is lived. Indeed, one of the essential purposes of Sharia is to create the sort of safe, secure, peaceful, harmonious community and family space which enhances one's opportunity to pursue the realization of Islam. Dar al-Harb is the realm where the deen or way of Islam has not been established. One who lives in Dar al-Harb is buffeted about by whatever sets of political, social, economic, philosophical, and spiritual forces that happen to be manifesting themselves in such a realm. Although a Muslim or Sufi who is exposed to the cross-currents of Dar al-Harb must, as best she or he can, still seek and act upon the truth inherent in divine guidance, there are definite differences between the two realms, and what may be expected in contexts where Islam is the umbrella that protects one from the forces which seek to undermine the process of seeking the truth, and in contexts where one is at the mercy of whatever forces shape the contours of the existential landscape, are not necessarily the same. Like everything else, there are differences of opinion among ulama and other interested parties, as in most of us, about what the shape of the boundaries should be in terms of the differences of expectation concerning individual behavior within Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb. To add a few twists and turns to the foregoing theme, one can put forth a persuasive case that presently there is no Darul Islam at all anywhere on the face of the earth. Stated alternatively, although many people may claim that the real Islam, whatever that is being practiced in this or that nation, in truth, there are numerous fundamental spiritual deficiencies in the way society is organized in virtually any nation one wishes to name. That is, there are numerous breaches of essential adab, trust, fiduciary responsibility, and justice which are being perpetrated in every country on earth. Furthermore, the revolutionary movements in each of these countries are really nothing but a variation on the same theme. And if they were to achieve power, what is likely to ensue is not unlike those cases where one sweeps and moves the dust around on a floor, but the dirt still remains. Things just seem different because the piles of dust have been moved about, freeing old categories of the oppressed while heaping debris on new categories of the oppressed. And for those who suppose that I might be picking on the Muslim community, the fact of the matter is, the same kinds of thing could be said with equal justification in relation to so-called democratic states. Let's return to some of the tools mentioned in the foregoing discussion that are available to us for trying to determine where the boundary lines are, about which Allah speaks in the Quran, that we should be wary of crossing or transgressing. For example, consider the term aql, or intellect. There is a hadith that indicates that aql was the first thing that Allah created. But what is this aql? There is a distinction drawn in the medieval Christian tradition between ratio and intellectus. Ratio gives expression to the use of ordinary logic and reasoning. Intellectus refers to the lights of spiritual understanding, that is, a manifestation of various forms of intuition, insight, unveiling, visionary states, as well as the illumination of different spiritual stations, each of which carries a different understanding concerning one's relationship with divinity. For ratio to be effective, it must work in harmony with and serve as a reflection of the findings and inspirations of the dimension of human understanding that is rooted in intellectus. Ratio is at best derivative in a faint fashion from the operation of intellectus, and at worst, ratio is completely out of sync with intellectus, and the two come into opposition with one another. Thus the Quran says of such circumstances, quote, "It is not their eyes which are blind, but the hearts in their breasts." And this is from Surah 22, Ayat 46. That is, people who are under the influence of a problematic modality of thinking have a certain capacity to see, but because their mode of understanding is not rooted in the illuminations of a rightly guided heart, such people, in effect, are blind because their way of thinking neither reflects nor gives expression to the truth. The medieval Christian tradition speaks of the intellectus in a collective way to encompass all those altered states of being which serve as manifestations of the lights of divine knowledge and witnessing. The teachings of the Sufi path have provided a means of focusing on various facets of this infinite source of understanding, knowledge, and wisdom to which the intellectus gives expression. Thus, the heart, seer, spirit, kafi, and akfa each contribute different dimensions of understanding with respect to one's relationship with God. The heart is the locus of gnosis. The seer or mystery is the locus of witnessing. The ruh or spirit is the locus of love. The kafi, or hidden, is the locus of dominicality through which various lights and colors of divinity are manifested. And the akfa is the locus through which essential identity and unique spiritual capacity are given expression. In fact, all of these faculties in coordinated combination give expression to the presence of intellectus according to one's individual capacity to manifest this presence. Moreover, there are practices, states, and stations associated with each modality of engaging the hakika, or reality of divinity, as one goes through a process of cleansing and calibration to ensure the purity, sincerity, and objectivity of one's experience of divinity, again, according to one's God-given capacity to do so. There are many people of Kalam, theology, philosophy, and jurisprudence, who suppose that the use of radio, quite independently of intellectus, is sufficient to arrive at sound judgments in matters of Sharia. In other words, such individuals try to reduce akal down to matters of exoteric logic and reasoning. That is, they try to divorce the intelligence of this world thinking and creativity from the intellect. And the latter is, in actuality, the first thing that Allah created and is far vaster, deeper, richer, more subtle, aware, flexible, insightful, and powerful than is the intelligence of everyday life. In short, many people confuse levels of reality, even as they understand, however dimly, that the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, demonstrated a clear difference between the two with respect to his days prior to being called to the prophetic life and the days following his response to that call. The Prophet, peace be upon him, was known as Al-Amin, the trustworthy or honest one, prior to his prophetic mission, because of the integrity of his intellect and ethical demeanor. And in the 23 years of his prophetic calling on earth, he was known as Nabi and Rasul. He was the locus of manifestation for miracles and spiritual illumination that were dispensed by the grace of Allah through the Prophet, peace be upon him, to people in accordance with their spiritual capacity. He was associated with such qualities because, by the grace of Allah, the intellectus had been made manifest in him according to the extraordinary spiritual capacity which divinity had bestowed upon him. Mere intellect is not capable of journeying to the heights of understanding to which the Prophet was brought during the mirage, literally ladder, and thus the means by which one ascends. And thus, even Jibril, peace be upon him, was forced to remain behind at the lote tree, while the Prophet, peace be upon him, went on alone. Quote, "And he revealed to his servant what he revealed." End of quote, and this is from the Quran, Surah 53, Ayat 10. Revealed not as a mental event, but as an opening of essential intellect. Only after the grace of God had been bestowed on Muhammad, peace be upon him, by means of the barakah of the prophetic mission, in an active form, could the potential of the Hakika Muhammadi be realized. Only after the foregoing grace had been given, could the Prophet, peace be upon him, say, quote, "The Sharia is my words, Tariqa my actions, Hakika my states, Gnosis my capital, intellect the basis of my deen, love my foundation, passion my mount, fear my companion, knowledge my weapon, forbearance my friend, trust my cloak, contentment my treasure, truthfulness my residence, certainty my refuge, poverty my glory, and by it I attain to an honor above the rest of the prophets and messengers." End of quote. Even if we restrict ourselves to the realm of radio, or the lesser form of akal, there are numerous problems which arise because of the difficulties encountered while trying to pin down just what is meant by logic and reasoning. In other words, there are many varieties of logic, including inductive, deductive, abductive, Socratic, Aristotelian, syllogistic, mathematical, formal, fuzzy, modal, dialectical, inferential, analogical, nonlinear, eidetic reductions, deconstructionist, and hermeneutical ways of thinking. We often recognize the quality of intellect in its fruits, while simultaneously being at a loss to explain how that soundness of thought comes to be in any of us. Furthermore, there are many different kinds of influences bearing upon whether we are inclined to treat something as rational, irrational, transrational, and the like. The foregoing influences are a function of a variety of considerations, assumptions, types of experience examined, the way facts are constructed, processes of evaluation, modalities of inference, implication, extrapolation and interpolation, styles of theory building, methods of verification, the questions which are left unanswered, the degree of rigor and quality sought during exploration, biases, blind spots, political and social influences, expectations, intentions, the issue of anomalous results, as well as the sort of hypotheses which are entertained can all affect the structural character of the conclusions one comes to in any conceptual context. When one employs qiyas, or analogy, which is a particular kind of expression of aql, for the purposes of linking a spiritual principle with a given problem, and in the process claims that something in the current dilemma can be likened to something to which a particular principle addresses itself, or vice versa. The fact of the matter is, almost anything can be likened to almost everything else. And as a result, sooner or later, all analogies tend to break down because similarity is not sameness. And it is the differences which give rise to the perturbations and anomalies out of which the sort of chaotic vibrations arise that eventually induce one to look for a different principle to treat as analogous to the problem at hand. The symbols of dreams are, in a sense, an analogy, since because the language of Alam al-Mithal, the world of symbols and similitudes, which is where dreams arise, marries together elements of the imaginal realm with elements of the physical realm, and the symbols and similitudes which are selected have an analogical relationship with the different facets of the physical realm that they are intended to allude to. One can take many facets of the Quran or the conduct of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and use these as a basis from which to construct a relationship of analogy between spiritual principles and the issues of life confronting us. However, if one starts from a problematic mode of characterizing the principles at work in relation to a given facet of the Quran or the life of the Prophet, peace be upon him, or if one misunderstands the nature of the problem being addressed, or if one commits both of these errors, then the method of qiyas may not be just unhelpful, but downright injurious. There are, to be sure, more stable, reliable, reflective, constructive, and heuristically valuable analogies, and there are less stable, reliable, reflective, constructive, and heuristically valuable analogies. The spiritual understanding of the source, whether dream, altered state of consciousness, individual, inspiration, to which a given analogy comes, is of critical importance. The better the source, the better the understanding that is being transmitted through the analogy. A fatwa is nothing more than a legal opinion which someone expresses about one's understanding concerning the boundary issues of a given set of circumstances. Despite what those who issue them might wish to suppose, fatwas are not binding. That is, they carry no necessary transcendent power of taqlid, that is, following authority, on anyone except those who accept the argument and reasoning employed in the decision. Moreover, whether anyone should accept the reasoning employed in such fatwas is entirely a different matter. The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, quote, "My ummah, community, will never agree in error," end of quote. He also indicated there are 73 different sects among Muslims, and only one of these is correct. Almost everyone supposes his or her approach to things is this correct way. But in truth, all that most of us know is that somewhere within the community, there is correct understanding along with a capacity to distinguish truth from error. However, the precise location or locations within the community where we might find this way is a real problematic issue, and in fact, this issue returns us to the boundary problem once again. In the meantime, since we know from the Prophet, peace be upon him, that his ummah will never agree in error, the disagreements which are evident everywhere in the Muslim world means that error does exist, and the task of every single individual is to try to separate the wheat from the chaff. Thus the Prophet, peace be upon him, has said, quote, "Seeking knowledge is an ordinance obligatory upon every Muslim," end of quote. And the Quran states, quote, "Say, my Lord, increase me in knowledge," end of quote. This challenge is made more difficult because there are all too many individuals within the Muslim community who are intent, whether innocently or otherwise, on propagating misinformation or disinformation, and such efforts merely cloud the atmosphere. As T.S. Eliot said, quote, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" End of quote. Perhaps in order to avoid certain difficulties, it may be important to point out that the boundary problems to which I have been alluding are not primarily about, say, the five basic pillars of Islam, that is, bearing witness to the oneness of divinity, prayers, fasting, zakat, and hajj, nor the basic components involved in the elements of faith, that is, acceptance of and commitment to the reality of the oneness of divinity, the prophetic tradition, the realm and function of angels, the books of Revelation, the Day of Judgment, and that God is a sole determiner of good and evil. To be sure, there are differences of opinion that have arisen about precisely how to interpret and put into practice these different pillars and components of faith. And this is why the five major schools of jurisprudence, or fiqh, that is, Maliki, Hanbali, Hanafi, Jafri, and Shafi, came into being in order to offer reasonable, well-considered, but somewhat divergent approaches to the problem of where to place certain boundary markers in relation to how people might conduct themselves with respect to life. Yet there are many other aspects of life which are not specifically about the five pillars or about the six articles of faith per se, but which have a huge impact on life in the way it is pursued. In fact, there is a major division within the Muslim community over even the purpose of Sharia. Some see it as a means for achieving paradise. Some see it as a prelude to something more. Some see Sharia as an all-encompassing expression of the principles upon which the universe is run, and in order for the nature of this divine law to be fully understood, one cannot restrict oneself to a purely exoteric and therefore limited manner of engaging being. The Prophet, peace be upon him, alluded to this latter possibility himself when he spoke of the fact that the Quran had both an outer and an inner meaning, and this inner meaning had an interior meaning, and so on for seven levels. Moreover, in this regard, the Prophet, peace be upon him, is reported to have said, quote, "There are hidden gems of knowledge unknown to all but those who know God. If they are spoken of, none denies them except those arrogant towards God." End of quote. A Bedouin once approached the Prophet, peace be upon him, and said, quote, "Tell me how I might achieve paradise." The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, "To attest to the oneness of God, to pray five times a day, to keep the fast during the month of Ramadan, to pay the zakat, and to perform the hajj at least once in one's life, if able to do so." Upon hearing this answer, the Bedouin said, "By Allah, I will do what you have indicated, nothing more and nothing less," and then left. The Prophet, peace be upon him, watched the man leave, and then turning to those who were with him, said, "If you wish to see an inmate of paradise, look to that yonder man." End of quote. The Prophet also said, quote, "This world is prohibited to the people of the next world, and the next world is forbidden to the people of this world, and they are both forbidden to the people of Allah." End of quote. In addition, the Quran says, quote, "And you shall be three sorts. Then as to the companions of the right hand, how happy are the companions of the right hand? And as to the companions of the left hand, how wretched are the companions of the left hand? And the foremost are the foremost. These are they who are drawn nigh to Allah. In the gardens of bliss, a numerous company from among the first, and a few from among the latter." End of quote. This is from Surah 56, verses 7 through 14. Nowhere in the Quran nor the Hadith does it say that the purpose of life is to achieve paradise. This issue is always addressed in the form of a conditional-like format. If you do certain things, then this is what follows. In other words, if you want paradise, then like the aforementioned Bedouin, do such and such. And if you want to avoid hell, then do such and such. Why is the next world forbidden to the people of Allah? Because the people of Allah are concerned only with Allah, not something else. And in a sense, paradise is something else. Although from another perspective, nothing really is other than Allah, albeit as a veiled manifestation of one or another, or some combination of the attributes and names of divinity. Even hell is a veiled manifestation of the divine presence in the form of justice, rigor, majesty, and certain other Jalali qualities. The Prophet, peace be upon him, never mentioned Hanafi, Maliki, Hanbali, Jafri, or Shafi schools of fiqh. He never mentioned Bukhari, Muslim, Dawood, Tirmizi, or any of the other compilers of hadith. The Prophet, peace be upon him, did say, quote, "If a person sits down in Islam, a good custom which is put into practice, that person will have written for oneself the wages of those who put it into practice, while nothing will be diminished from their wages. And if a person sets down in Islam a bad custom which puts into practice, then this person will have written for one the load of those who put it into practice, while nothing will be diminished from their loads." End of quote. The creators of the various schools of fiqh, along with the compilers of hadith who forged the methodological principles through which such compilations were collected, have all set down good customs in Islam. People who read and act upon the fruits of the labor of such individuals will, inshallah, derive much benefit. Communities that abide by such frameworks also may derive, God willing, much constructive benefit. For each of the schools of fiqh provides people with a way of creating, God willing, a sort of safe space within which Islam may be pursued in peace. However, are there no other possibilities for the establishing of systems of good custom in conjunction with issues of jurisprudence, governance, community arrangements, and the like? Some people have answered this question with a loud no, claiming that the door of ijtihad, or individual striving in relation to such matters, has been closed. To the best of my knowledge, none of the people who have made such a claim was the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And therefore, the foregoing no really lacks binding authority on anyone except those who reason along similar lines. And furthermore, anyone who seeks to use force in order to compel compliance with such a perspective is transgressing the boundaries which Allah has established in matters of spirituality. Namely, there can be no compulsion in matters of deen. And this is from Surah 2, Ayat 256. There is a significant degree of confusion among many Muslims about the meaning of the term bid'ah, or innovation. There are any number of hadiths in which the Prophet, peace be upon him, speaks disparagingly of and warns against adopting practices that involve bid'ah. However, there are acceptable forms of bid'ah and there are unacceptable forms of innovation. For instance, during the lifetime of the Prophet, peace be upon him, special prayers known as Tarawih were said in congregation by the Prophet, peace be upon him, on only several occasions, after which he discontinued the congregational aspect of the prayers. When asked why the prayers had been discontinued in their public format, the Prophet, peace be upon him, is reported to have answered, quote, "I was afraid people would come to consider the prayers to be obligatory, and I did not wish to burden them in this manner." End of quote. During the caliphate of Hazrat Omar, may Allah be pleased with him, he reinstituted the practice of saying the Tarawih prayers in congregation. When people inquired about the legitimacy of this policy and alleged that it constituted bid'ah, Hazrat Omar, may Allah be pleased with him, indicated that yes, the practice did constitute bid'ah, but bid'ah hasanat, that is, good or constructive bid'ah. In order for something to be considered a problematic expression of the kind of bid'ah about which the Prophet, peace be upon him, had warned, there are certain conditions that need to be satisfied, or if you like, violated. First, the practice must clearly contradict or be in opposition to the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace be upon him. Secondly, one cannot say in order to induce compliance with a given practice that if one follows the practice, then God will reward that person. Or thirdly, one cannot claim that if one does not comply with that practice, then the non-compliant individual will be punished by divinity. Finally, if the intention underlying the implementation of some new policy is to help enhance faith, then providing none of the other three conditions have been transgressed, the new practice does not constitute an instance of problematic bid'ah. Unfortunately, there are many self-styled religious leaders and supposed spiritual scholars who like throwing the label or charge of bid'ah at anything with which they do not agree or don't like or do not approve. They recite the relevant hadith of the Prophet, peace be upon him, concerning the issue of bid'ah, and then proceed to imply that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was talking about precisely the sort of thing to which such self-serving leaders are opposed, when the Prophet, peace be upon him, may not have had in mind whatever it is that the so-called leaders don't like. In truth, these individuals really have no idea of what the Prophet, peace be upon him, was alluding to, and they use the context of ambiguity to claim that the Prophet, peace be upon him, comments about bid'ah lend credence to their arguments, when such may not be the case, and in point of fact, may be nothing but a shoddy attempt at misleading people. Join me, God willing, in the next edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast, part 2 of The Boundary Problem.
This week's edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life.
Well, that's all for this edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast. I hope you have enjoyed the program and found the various segments thought-provoking and interesting. As indicated in the introduction to this podcast, programs will be produced on a regularly irregular basis. Essentially, this means that the next edition may appear next week, or then again, there may not be another podcast for several weeks. Sufi Reflections gets done, God willing, as time permits. And unfortunately, time doesn't always permit me the degrees of freedom necessary to put programs together, which is a lot more time-consuming than the running length of any given podcast. Nonetheless, I will strive mightily to provide a new program for your listening enjoyment in the near future. Until then, Assalamu alaikum.